You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. In today's show, we are honoring the life of Murray Gell-Mann, the great scientist who died on May 24th. We'll be back in just a half a minute. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is currently accepting applications for Northern New Mexico Tribal Business Scholarships. These awards are for Native American students attending four-year undergraduate programs in business-related fields in or out of New Mexico. The application deadline is June 15th. For more information, visit lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. That's lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. Or call 505-753-8890, extension 115. Today's show honors Murray Gell-Mann, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist who made his home in Santa Fe and was co-founder of the Santa Fe Institute, a center for what's now called complexity science. He died on Friday, May 24th. Gell-Mann not only made major contributions to physics, including the discovery of the subatomic particle called the quark, but he also worked in many other areas of science, including cosmology, linguistics, archaeology, history, and economics, and the relationships among them. This kind of deep interdisciplinary thinking is at the heart of complexity science, which seeks to understand natural and human systems like ecosystems, economics, weather patterns, and so on, by using methods and theories from many different disciplines and seeing their connections. Scientist and current Santa Fe Institute president David Krakauer said Gell-Mann had a mind both cavernous and extensive, animated by the most intense fire of roguish curiosity I have ever beheld. We're going to hear today an interview that I recorded with Murray Gell-Mann in the winter of 2013. With this, we send our condolences to all those who loved and were influenced by him, and our appreciation of both his contributions to science and his extraordinary spirit. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Murray Gell-Mann. He is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. He's professor of theoretical physics emeritus at California Institute of Technology. He's a distinguished fellow and co-founder of the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So we are here to talk about maybe a lot of things, but to start with the whole question of what science is as a way of working, as a way of thinking, as a way of perceiving the world, and how it differs from other attempts at telling the truth about the world. What is science?
Well, I think we all agree it's a systematic effort to understand what's going on in the world. And you can extend the definition to include various ways of apprehending the world, or you can stick to ones that are generally labeled as science. It's more restrictive.
Right. I mean, and even within science, there are so many different ways of doing it. I mean, what theoretical physicists do and what conservation or wildlife biologists do sitting out in nature all day long is so different. What unites them?
Well, it's all part of the organized effort to understand what's happening. And you can do that, as you say, in various ways. And there's always the possibility of doing some theory. And obviously you have to do some observation. They can be done by different people or sometimes by the same person.
How old is science? What are some of the oldest examples of the practice of science in our world?
Well, it depends on how broad you make the definition. There was certainly some scientific activity in remote antiquity.
What did that look like?
By the time we get the so-called library at Alexandria, a couple of hundred years BCE, you have recognizable science, science recognizable as the same activity as it is now. When Eratosthenes figured out how big the Earth is, for example, was a very good example of science.
How did he do that?
Well, he used the length of the shadow of a stick, particular size, at places with different latitudes.
So they knew, he knew the world was round, the Earth was round.
Approximately spherical, that's right.
And what are some other examples from antiquity?
Well, at the museum, which is a kind of institute for advanced study in Alexandria, there were various activities, including invention. There was Heron, who invented the steam engine, the little toy steam engine. So that would be considered science or engineering today.
You have periods where we seem to go backwards, like we knew the world was spherical and that there were latitudes and longitudes that you could stand at and make calculations, and then the world was flat again until it was considered...
For some people, yeah, yeah. We have the equivalent of flat Earth people today.
True. So in terms of modern science, science as it's practiced today, what does it look like? How does it differ from what came before?
Well, it's sort of fluctuated. The Arabs and Persians preserved many of the old Greek advances in science and mathematics. And then, after many centuries, modern science emerged, continuing that work. And in particular, a modern attitude can be traced in the 17th century, when King Charles II was restored to the throne in 1660. He immediately set up the Royal Society of London to do what was called natural philosophy, which is the same as what we call science today. It's natural philosophy because it was based on observations of nature, not armchair speculation.
And so what were the observations that they were doing at that time?
Well, we can look at Isaac Newton, who had the idea that the laws of motion of small objects in a gravitational field might be the same laws that governed the motion of the planets or the moon around the Earth. And he wrote that he refrained from discussing this similarity in his book, lest he be thought an extravagant freak and detract from the main message of the book. But he had this idea that nature was similar to itself in different places, which is a very interesting idea. It's a very modern idea.
Right. And when he advanced this theory of gravitation, how was it received?
Oh, it was pretty well received. He succeeded in persuading many people, I think.
Not all breakthroughs in science have been so well received.
Well, that's absolutely right. Frequently, what happens is that people develop certain habits of thinking that make certain alternatives impossible and unbelievable. And for a while, then, one mustn't say those forbidden things because they're forbidden. They're wrong. Actually, they aren't wrong. The principles that make them wrong are incorrect principles. But because they violate those principles, these items are rejected.
Well, your own work is an example of that.
My own work is an example, yes. For example, the quarks violated three wrong principles. One was that the neutron and proton are elementary and not made up of simpler things. It's a nice idea, but it's not true. That elementary particles would have to have integral electric charges, like minus one, zero, plus one, and so on, not minus a third or plus two-thirds. Well, that turned out to be false also. The third principle was that you mustn't have particles that are permanently confined inside things that are observable, so that you can't bring them out and work with them individually and make practical use of them directly. Well, the quarks are like that. They have fractional charges. They are more basic than the neutron and proton. Neutron and proton are composed of them. Roughly speaking, three quarks to each neutron or proton. And they're trapped inside objects like the neutron and proton. Can't be extracted singly to be used in industry. There's no quarkonics industry, which otherwise would be flourishing.
Right.
So the quarks violated these three wrong principles. Another example is continental drift. American students of geology were taught, in general, that continental drift was simply wrong. And all the kids who asked their teachers, look at those continents. weren't they all together at one time? Because they fit so nicely. All those students were told, don't believe it. It's just some appearance. It's not a fundamental truth. It's not really so.
And the school children were right.
The school children were right.
And how was that proved?
Well, a whole series of observations of phenomena at different times showed that the continents had been united. And about 200 million years ago, they formed a single one, which is called Pangaea. And then it broke up into several pieces and became finally the distributed landmass that we have today.
This whole question of when truths are discovered and there is great resistance in the scientific community, and then eventually so much evidence piles up that people are forced to see the error of their wrong thinking ways. Is that resistance a good thing?
Well, it may be a natural part of the system. People have to be taught something, and they're taught, among other things, they're taught these wrong principles.
I guess what I'm getting at is, I guess I think that that resistance would also kind of play the role of keeping other wrong theories out of our textbooks.
Yes, that's part of that was what I was trying to say. You said it much better, that part of what's transmitted from one time to the next is a set of ideas, set of principles, and some of them are wrong.
What about evolution? It seems to me that that is not only a principle that was revolutionary and that encountered resistance and then overcame that resistance, but it also changed the way we thought about so many things in a very fundamental way.
Yes, absolutely. It's an insight that avoids having to have a designer.
And up until that time, there was a designer. That was the way we thought about many all life on Earth.
Many people thought about things in terms of a designer. Yes, today there's still such people today.
Right. I mean, you say there are still such people today. Why do you think it is that ideas that are clearly wrong continue to persist in significant minority communities or subcultures?
Well, it's difficult for me to explain, because I don't share these ways of thinking, but there are certainly lots of people who are attached to particular ways of looking at the world that don't agree with scientific conclusions. Not everybody reasons scientifically.
Partly just because not everybody is really taught to in school.
Well, I don't know whether it's exactly that, but there's a natural tendency to personify nature, for example. So-called primitive peoples can look at a thunderstorm and say there must be an old man up there who's angry. it's a sort of natural way to think at a certain level.
Are there, in science, things that we know for sure, like fundamental facts or theories about which we're certain, we know they're not going to change? I mean, we're talking about things where there have really been major changes in the way we think. What about things that aren't going anywhere?
Well, I think we have to be careful there. People who try to explain science to the public often emphasize very strongly that everything is up for grabs. Any ideas we have can be changed later by new information, and theories replaced by other theories that are survive various tests of experience. Well, it's true to some extent, but there are lots of things that are very unlikely to change. If you jump off a tall building, you'll probably fall down. That's probably not going to change.
Which basically means that Newton's theories of gravitation and motion and so on aren't going anywhere.
Well, they have changed. General relativity has altered our view of gravitation. There's a new theory, the 20th century theory, that's different from Newton's. It reduces to Newton's when the velocities are small and the gravitational fields are weak. But under other conditions, it's different.
But the jumping off of a building thing
That part will probably stay.
And the periodic table.
Yes, mostly, yes. But the periodic table, of course, has been extended and changed over time to fit newly discovered facts. So it's true that things are subject to change, but we have to realize that many things that we believe on the basis of evidence will stay nearly the same. It's important to distinguish.
What are some of those things that we can count on that are going to stay the same? Okay, jumping off a building, we got that one.
Well, conservation of energy, quite a number of such fundamental principles are relatively resistant to change.
We're talking to physicist Murray Gell-Mann. You have written and spoken quite a bit about, to put it simply, the relationship between truth and beauty mm-hmm. in science. Mm-hmm. How can you describe, for those of us who are not scientists and mathematicians, some examples of that relationship?
Yes. The question is, why should elegance or simplicity or beauty or whatever you want to call it, why should something like that be a successful criterion for choosing a correct theory in fundamental physics? And what I claim is that it doesn't have much to do with our human characteristics, that any intelligent life form or any intelligent entity could reach the same conclusions that we humans do about fundamental scientific truths, particularly laws of physics, the fundamental laws of physics. And that what's involved here is not something that has specially to do with human beings and their characteristics, but rather with the nature of the fundamental laws themselves. And what I claim is that these fundamental laws have a property, which is that their manifestations at different scales, especially different scales of distance or different scales of energy, that those manifestations resemble one another. There's a kind of self-similarity. Isaac Newton was very aware of that and talked about nature conformable to herself. And by that he meant not only that the gravitational laws that were obeyed by a falling apple or something like that and the gravitational laws that governed the moon's motion around the Earth, that they were the same laws, not only that, but that the different forces themselves might show similarities in their descriptions. And what I claim is that any intelligent entity that was exploring the laws of fundamental laws of physics would follow a similar course to others, that they would start with rather long distances and rather low energies and work their way up to shorter distances and higher energies. And as they did so, they would discover that the laws were sort of self-similar. They exhibited a certain similarity from one scale to another, one scale of distance to another or one scale of energy to another. And that similarity would look like truth, would look like simplicity or beauty.
Now, when you say any intelligent entity, not talking about dolphins. Those are the other kind of intelligent entities we know.
Well, I was assuming that there were ones intelligent enough to do scientific work, scientific theory.
Right. So extraterrestrials?
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, why not? Yes. There's a huge universe out there. And having stars with planets is not unusual. In fact, many of those planets have recently been discovered nearby. And presumably far away, they exist far away as well. So there are lots and lots and lots of planets out there going around stars. And there's nothing particularly special about life as far as we can tell. It should, if you have the right physical conditions, it has a certain probability of starting up. So why shouldn't there be all sorts of things out there? Maybe very far away. I'm not saying they're close by and about to land here. But somewhere out there, there should be intelligent entities.
Who were discovering
the laws of nature. And my belief is that they would be discovering the same laws in different guises, different methods of description.
And perhaps experiencing elegance and beauty in a way that's similar to what we are doing.
Through the self-similarity, yes. The self-similarity would lead people to use the same mathematics for the new theory, or approximately the same mathematics for the new theory that they used for the old one. And that would lead them to believe that the new description was beautiful, was simple, because it was easily expressed. The new stuff was easily expressed in the same terms, or almost the same terms as the old stuff.
What are some other examples that we can understand of self-similarity?
Well, the different forces. For instance, the 1 over r squared, 1 over distance squared law of force for gravitational attraction, which is the same 1 over distance squared as for the repulsion between electrical objects, or attraction if they have opposite signs for the charges, for the electric charges. So Newton's law for gravitation and Coulomb's law for charged particles have approximately the same form, 1 over distance squared for the force.
I also think of things like the fact that rivers seen from above when you're going in an airplane look an awful lot like, for example, blood vessels or veins and leaves. Is that another?
Absolutely, yes. Very important one. No, there are lots of such things, and they give the impression of simplicity and, to some people, of beauty. So it's the self-similarity of the results of the fundamental laws that's involved here.
And it does lead to a kind of a contemplation or meditation on what beauty really means, because by some definitions it's really subjective and it's in the eye of the beholder and so on.
Yes, well, you don't have to use the word beauty. You can just talk about simplicity or self-similarity or whatever you think it's.
But beauty does, but it's true. There's a kind of resonance when we see things and a sense of rightness when
Absolutely.
We perceive something that is beautiful.
Absolutely. Back in 1956-57, one of my colleagues and I wrote an article about our view of the so-called weak interaction, which gives rise to beta disintegration and things of that kind. And we noticed that there were 7 experiments that contradicted our theory. And we published it anyway, because we thought it was so beautiful, meaning simple, easily expressed in terms of things we already knew. Certain similarities to electromagnetism, for example. And we published it anyway, and it turned out that all those 7 experiments were wrong. Either actually incorrect or wrongly interpreted. And the theory was right.
And you knew the theory was right because it was simply expressed and beautiful.
Yeah. And the explanation, I think, is that the fundamental laws are there, and they have this property that their manifestations at different lengths and different energies and so on, resemble one another. Self-similarity, proximate self-similarity.
And this is true in biology as well as physics.
Yes.
Which are very different from one another in the sense that life has a kind of complexity and inherent change in it that physics doesn't have.
That's right. But there is a good deal of self-similarity there, too.
And it would also apply that the simple solution or the simple theory and the elegant theory tends to be true in biology?
Well, the simplicity isn't quite so great in biology. It's a lot more variation and a lot more diversity. But otherwise, yes, with that caveat.
We're talking to physicist Murray Gell-Mann. Let's talk about diversity for a moment. One of the things that is of great concern to many of us, and I know to you, is the preservation of species on this earth, of biodiversity. Why is biodiversity so important?
It's not only biodiversity. I think it's important to preserve a certain amount of cultural diversity also, for human cultural diversity. It's taken a very long time to evolve. The situation today of diversity in biology, and it's similarly the diversity of human culture. Different languages, different traditions, different myths, different ideas. And to lose all that richness that's taken such a long time to accumulate would be a pity. Doesn't mean we have to believe in a lot of ancient myths, but to preserve them as examples of ways in which humans can think is, I think, important.
I mean, when we talk about biodiversity,
yes,
and there are so many little tiny species with a few cells or plants or animals or fish and all these creatures, and maybe they don't seem important, and yet without them, the greater system falls apart, or without some critical mass of them, the greater system falls apart.
Yes, I think you have it exactly right, that we should probably not think in terms of preserving every detail, and at the same time, we shouldn't think of sacrificing most of the variety, most of the diversity, but some reasonable compromise is probably what can be achieved.
I can't help but wonder if, where culture is concerned, that it's the same kind of thing. If you lose too many languages or if you lose too many cultural practices, somehow society begins to fall apart.
Society becomes a lot less interesting anyway. I don't know exactly how to describe my views, but they seem to be the same as yours.
We're going through, what is it, the sixth great species extinction right now? And it's the first one that's been caused by human agency.
Well, that's true, yes.
What are the potential, I mean, besides it would be a shame to lose them and diversity is a beautiful thing, what are the actual survival risks to losing so many species?
I don't think that's been thoroughly explored yet, but there are plenty of people thinking about it and trying to work on it, figure out in simple, practical terms what the problems and dangers are in these extinction, in this latest anthropogenic extinction.
You've done quite a lot of work looking at the reality of climate change. What are some of the misconceptions that people have about climate and about weather?
Climate involves what we can call a certain coarse graining of the data on weather.
What does that mean?
In other words, simplifying a little bit, the averaging over fluctuations, averaging over various details. In other words, a certain degree of simplification is what reveals climate, as distinct from trying to talk about the exact weather in every place at every time. And what I think a number of people fail to appreciate is that the signal that we get in changes in the weather, changes, for example, in the temperature, the average temperature, that these signals consist of several terms, several pieces added together. There are the random fluctuations, or fluctuations that we have to treat as random because we can't do any better. There are periodic or almost periodic changes. And then there is a steady change, a steady drift, what we call a secular term.
Secular.
Added in. Just, for example, just a gradual rise in average temperature. And this secular trend, because it keeps growing, will eventually win out over the fluctuations and over the periodic terms. And everybody will have to agree that it's there. There won't be a lot of argument about it. However, if we wait for that, it will be too late to do very much about it. Whereas now, when it's still comparable to other things, instead of drowning them out, we might be able to do something about the results. So it's, I think, important to look at warming, global warming, and pay serious attention to it.
Which the consensus of scientists is in fact real and is in fact happening.
Yes, and the fact that it was cold last year doesn't change this statement about the average situation.
Again, there's this question of why people are so resistant and why particularly political bodies are so resistant to making the changes that are necessary.
Well, they cost something, probably. Some of the changes have a negative economic effect on certain people or certain practices.
Which is probably a negligible cost compared to the cost of not doing anything.
Eventually, as this term gets larger and larger, yes, it becomes a very serious matter. But the thought of saving the cost of doing something outweighs for many people the dangers of allowing it to happen.
We're talking to physicist Murray Gell-Mann. Here at the Santa Fe Institute, one of the things that, well, you've been involved in it since the beginning, is this whole practice of bringing people from different scientific disciplines together who are trained differently and have different ways of thinking and different methods of working. What are some of the benefits of bringing all these different kinds of scientific thinking together that have actually happened here at the Institute?
Well, we believe it's a big improvement to have this kind of institution. Doesn't mean that every institution has to be of that kind. One can have specialized institutions that deal in particular scientific disciplines with particular traditions and so on. There's no harm in that, and some good, probably. But they need to be supplemented by institutions where the various scientific insights are combined, and people are allowed to work and encouraged to work on things other than what they were trained to do. So one can have, as in our institute, little self-assembled teams of people trained in various scientific disciplines, working together and contributing their various insights.
And what are some of the discoveries that have come from that?
It's a very good question. I haven't made an actual list, but there are many subjects that have benefited from it.
Would complexity theory be?
Oh, yes. Yes, complexity theory, definitely. And lots of ideas about entropy and lots of ideas about the details of evolutionary theory, the tension between concentrating on single organism selection as opposed to group selection.
What do you mean by those terms?
In theory of evolutionary biology, one talks about the consequences of some change in the germplasm, in the germ cells. Does that produce on this in the rest of the organism, the somatic cells, does that produce a benefit or a disadvantage? And you look at it in terms of the individual organism. Is an individual organism going to live longer or be more resistant to infection or something of that kind? Or on the contrary, more subject to something lethal through this change? And of course, natural selection then operates on that system. But another possibility is that you have to think of the effect on the group. And this is particularly true of human social situations. Are there cases where the whole group, the whole tribe or whatever, benefits or suffers as a result of some change? So you have selection, natural selection, operating on the group rather than operating on the individual level. And there's been a lot of argument about whether you can have any group selection. I don't know why. It seems fairly evident to me that there is some, at least some group selection taking place, but it's been very controversial. Nowadays, I think less so, but for a long time, I think it was quite controversial. Many examples like that.
On a completely different note, one thing that I have noticed is that a lot of hardcore scientists, or I just should say a lot of scientists, seem also to be atheists. Do those two things necessarily go together?
Not necessarily, but in many cases they do. They certainly do in my case.
And why is that?
I think Laplace stated it in a very nice way. He said God was not a hypothesis that he had found necessary.
I guess when I think about that question, I think about, again, questions of diversity. So on the one hand, we talk about what's true and proving the truth of either a god or a deity or whatever you want to call these so-called supernatural forces may be impossible. On the other hand, they represent a huge part of the cultural diversity, which we think is very important.
That's right. And they seem to be so widespread that they must represent some kind of rather fundamental human characteristic. Belief in those things seems to be rather almost universal for groups of human beings. That's interesting.
It is indeed.
And but it doesn't necessarily prove the truth of the idea, the fact that they're so widespread.
Well, there's belief and there's also experience. So people's experience of whatever it might be, mysticism or other forces, is an ongoing recurring experience of human culture.
But that's another story. I've thought a good deal about that. There are what some people call altered states of consciousness or something of that kind, trance states and so forth. And those are real. Those are genuine psychological phenomena and important ones. And they can be studied and reproduced. And some of them are called religious experience. But it doesn't necessarily imply the truth of supernatural, of stories about supernatural effects. They can be incorporated into our ideas of what nature is. And in many cases, people are discussing and teaching ideas about these transformed states without having experienced them. So you have people who have not experienced these things explaining them to other people who haven't experienced them. And the experience itself can be quite powerful, apparently.
Well, and what is gathered from the experience as meaning, as beauty, as a sense of truth, those are also important human phenomena.
Absolutely. And all of these things are important human phenomena. Love is an extremely important human phenomenon, extraordinarily important in many different contexts, as you know. Yes, all of the existence of all of these things and their importance does not depend on supernatural tales about them. You can refrain from believing the supernatural tales and at the same time believe in and experience and work with all of these phenomena, important and fundamental as they are.
I've often wondered whether one of the big resistances that people in this country and perhaps around the world have to a purely scientific explanation of reality is precisely the phenomenon of love. So if you think of love in sociobiological terms, like I meet somebody and I want to combine my genes with them to produce the most viable offspring, it's so reductionist that we don't want to believe it.
Yes, well, the reductionist approach can be largely correct and at the same time incomplete. And I think that's the proper, I believe that's the proper way to look at these things. That reductionism, in principle, is correct. So consciousness presumably flows from ordinary neurobiology and so on, just the way life emerges from chemistry and physics. But that's not a complete description of life. To look at the situation holistically is also important. To see life emerging from its chemical, physical underlying effects is very important. And the phenomenon of love also is emergent. This whole idea of emergence strengthens thinking, strengthens our ideas, I believe.
What do you mean? What do we mean by emergence?
I mean, you don't need something new. You don't need to assume something new in order to get something new. You don't have to introduce a vital force, such as they believed in 150 years ago. You don't need to introduce a vital force into the laws of nature. Life will obey ordinary physics and chemistry and at the same time behave like life. And consciousness will behave like consciousness, even though it's comprised of physics and chemistry, including neurobiology and so on and so forth. You don't need to introduce a separate new effect in order to get these new effects.
And so how do you complete your understanding of love from the reductionist perspective?
The reductionist perspective is part of the description, and the rest of the description has to do with love.
Which does not fall under scientific explanation.
Well, it does in a way. There's a scientific explanation, and then there's a lot more. And that lot more is what I'm referring to when I talk about emergence. I think emergence saves the mind a lot of unnecessary effort. You acknowledge the relevance of reduction. reduction is possible, but it's not a complete description. You need to say a lot more to convey the important things. For example, about love.
Well, it seems, I mean, this is where I feel like in order to have a complete picture, you have to go outside of science. You have to go into art and poetry and filmmaking and drawing and things like that.
Yes, yes. Or expand your notion of science to include those things. That's another possibility.
Do you do that?
Well, when I was a child, I certainly tried to do that. I thought if I read a great novel, that it was a contribution to understanding society and human beings and so on at the time and place described in the novel. And it was like something like science, because it gave me an insight into how things were working. So I think that I think there have been a number of stages in the development of human thought in which they did not try to make these sharp distinctions. When you improve our understanding of the situation, whether it's through writing a wonderful poem or through composing a piece of music or through playing something, playing some musical instrument in a brilliant way and so on. All of that can contribute to enlarging our understanding. And so it's a sort of part of, in a way, it's part of science. Or you can say it the other way, as you said it, that you have to go outside of science to things that are not normally considered science in order to get a complete view of what's happening.
I guess that it seems to me that the arts and sciences do or should inform one another.
Yes, I think so. I think so. I think they're part of a whole panoply of human, wonderful human properties. And other organisms, other entities in the universe must have analogs of these things as well. Things that are emergent phenomena. Even if something has seven tentacles and a brain shaped like a pretzel and four eyes, one above another, this could still have all these emergent features, including love and including other things.
Are you a fan of science fiction?
I used to be when I was a kid, yes. I learned a great deal from science fiction.
Really?
Well, there were a number of scientific phenomena that were described in science fiction and ignored mostly otherwise.
Do you remember examples of that?
I should be able to. For example, antimatter. Nobody ever mentioned antimatter in our school. But there it was in science fiction stories.
We're talking to physicist Murray Gell-Mann. What do you think are some of the most interesting directions that science is going right now?
Oh, gosh, that's very hard to answer. I couldn't say, but there's dramatic progress in so many fields of science.
Are there any technologies or methodologies that you think are opening up new areas for scientific inquiry?
Oh, I'm sure there are, but I'm not a great expert on these things. But I'm sure that's true, that there are very many new technologies developing, and many of them connected with advances in understanding.
What about just the phenomenon of vastly increased computational power?
Well, that, of course, is remarkable. It's the cheapness, and it's the fact that that information is so cheap and so quick to be transmitted that's remarkable about this age. Because we've had almost instantaneous transmission since the telegraph was invented more than 150 years ago. But it was expensive, and we had to be very careful how many words we put into a telegram and so on. So
right.
And now that's not the case. We have huge, huge capacity and tremendous speed of transmission, and it makes information almost trivially convenient. So that gives rise to this phenomenon of big data, huge, huge amounts of data that need to be digested and understood in various ways.
Help me to understand what this big data phenomenon is. I've heard that term, but I'm not sure what it means.
It means this huge amount of stuff, gigantic numbers of bits of information.
So you've got information coming in from satellites in space, from the internet,
oh, yes.
From society.
Oh, yes.
And then our challenge is what to do with it.
That's right.
What are we doing with it?
We're using it in some useful ways, and who knows about the rest. But learning to make effective use of it is a very big task for all of us. There's so much to be learned, but we need to figure out how to learn, especially how to select certain features to follow up.
Right. I mean, it seems like with the big data thing, there is an opportunity to see really big patterns.
Yeah, that's right. One thing that people have talked about is data mining, which is probably not the last word, because it suggests to me a kind of mindless search for regularities, which may not be what's most needed. It may be that what's most needed is the creation of theories, which can then be verified or falsified by comparison with data. It may be that data mining itself is not adequate as a response to the existence of all these things. It's too—it's not sensitive enough to the role played by the different kinds of data. But who knows? We'll have to see how it works out. But there's no doubt that it's important. If you just think of, for example, of police functions, which are rather obvious, you can listen in. And this has all sorts of implications for civil rights and so on and so forth. But forget that. You can listen in on conversations all over the country, all over the world. But what are you hearing? What relevance does it have? Who's talking? Why is that person talking? And to whom? And what's happening? And so on and so on. You have to dig deeper and deeper and deeper to make use of this, all these conversations. And there's so many of them that it's a pretty much hopeless task to take them all into consideration.
Or like our emails.
Yes, right, and so on and so forth. So it's tricky, but obviously poses important challenges.
What are you working on?
Well, I've done a good deal of work on new definitions for entropy, new formulae for entropy. Under different circumstances, it may be that you use different formulae. Usually it's the average of the log of the probability that's used to define entropy. But there may be circumstances in which you need more general definitions. And we've been working on that. That's one thing we've been working on. Another thing I've been working on is to understand better the underlying meaning of quantum mechanics. We all know that quantum mechanics works. It works amazingly well. We don't know of anything that disproves it anywhere. But to understand why it's how it's saying what it says is actually a little difficult. And there's still room for exploration of the underlying meaning of quantum mechanics. The way it's taught goes back all the way back to Heisenberg, who first discovered it, and Bohr, who helped him explain it. And this explanation is, I think, dated. I think it's not what we need today. I think we need a better explanation. They talked in terms of human beings and human beings measuring things and human beings recording things and so on and so on and so forth. And it's a rather narrow interpretation. You should be able to have quantum mechanics and take away the human beings and still have an explanation of quantum mechanics.
Besides the fact that human beings have figured this stuff out.
But somewhere else in the universe, other things have figured it out, probably.
And it's the same laws.
Yes, that's what I think.
Which is so interesting because it's, I guess the idea is that it's the same physical laws throughout the universe, unchanging, stable. If it works here, it works 1,000 galaxies away.
Right.
But that's probably not at all true of biological life.
Oh, who knows? It's much more diverse in each place. But if you allow for that huge diversity and average over it and so on, it may be that something somewhat similar happens.
10 galaxies away.
Yeah. You just have to go very far, maybe. We don't know what the distance is to the nearest intelligent entities. Just because we can talk about, with considerable confidence, about their existence, we don't have good ways of estimating how dense they are, how they're distributed. So it may be that we have to go very, very, very far away to get another kind of entity that's doing theoretical physics and so on. Or it may be that it's not very far.
Roswell.
I don't think we know. Well, those things are not serious.
Right. I'm just kidding.
Unfortunately. No, the quality of that evidence is very, very poor.
Murray Gell-Mann, thank you so much for being with me on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure. And I should say, with reference to Roswell, that if you visit Roswell, you will discover a street with two different organizations on opposite sides of the street, one of which believes that there are these extraterrestrial entities and that they're evil, and the other believes that they exist and they are benevolent. And these groups hate each other.
Which may represent basic strands of human history and ways of thinking. Well, Murray, thank you so much again for being with us.
Oh, well, it's been a great pleasure.
That was a conversation with Murray Gell-Mann recorded in 2013. Once again, Murray Gell-Mann passed away on May 24th, 2019. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanl Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.